voudrais juste de deux mots vous présenter la prochaine intervenante, Jennifer Cromwell, qui est coptisante, coptologue, je ne sais pas comment dire, et qui s'occupe tout particulièrement des pratiques scribales dans l'Égypte de l'Antiquité tardive et aussi du début de l'époque arabe. Alors je voudrais citer, elle a une actualité, si je puis dire, extrêmement intense, puisqu'à la fin de l'année 2017, début d'année 2018, il y a deux livres qui viennent de paraître, qu'elle a signé, Recording Village Life, A Coptic Scribe in Early Islamic Egypt. C'est un livre publié sous les presses de l'Université de Michigan et qui s'attache à dresser le portrait d'un scribe, un certain Aristophane, fils de Jean, et à travers lui des conditions historiques, des conditions culturelles, intellectuelles, etc., dans lesquelles il s'est formé. Et puis, elle a co-signé avec Eitan Grossman un ouvrage qui s'appelle Scribal Repertoires in Egypt from the New Kingdom to the Early Islamic Period, publié à Oxford, qui est un ouvrage collectif qui tente d'éclairer sur la longue durée la formation et les pratiques scribales, indépendamment, je dirais, des domaines linguistiques spécifiques dont elle relève. Donc c'est vraiment quelqu'un qui s'intéresse aux scribes, à leurs conditions de formation, etc., à leurs pratiques. Et donc elle a un domaine d'expertise dont on ne pouvait pas se passer aujourd'hui. Donc voilà. Jennifer, thank you so much for being here. And we are looking forward to listening to you.
Thank you very much, Jean-Luc, for the generous introduction, and to you and Judith for the invitation. I can only apologize for speaking in English and for the deplorable quality of my French, which 3 years in Denmark has not aided in any way. So, and also as a thank you to Pierre-Luc for addressing many of the terminological issues which I will address in part, although I'm very happy he referred so much to the Bunchich volume and the issues of terminology and individual versus general terminology and the applicability. I won't go into the issues in quite as much detail as Pierre-Luc did, although they do set a very nice framework for some of the issues that I'll discuss. And so today I'm talking about Coptic Greek biscriptality and more broadly how this fits in with my interest in the role and use of Coptic in the early Islamic Egypt. So after the conquest of Egypt in 641 AD, at a time 1,000 years after Alexander the Great's conquest of Egypt, the historical context framed by Pierre-Luc, and more than 1,000 years of Egyptian-Greek language contact and the development of Coptic from the Old Coptic, 2nd, 3rd century AD. And Coptic is the written form of the Egyptian language, employing the Greek alphabet with some additions and a huge number of Greek loanwords. So in terms of multilingualism and language contact, we have very different issues to Demotic Greek influence. Today, I'm going to be drawing upon texts from four main sites in Egypt, Hermopolis and the nearby monastery of Apu Apollo at Barit, Aphrodite and the village Jamei built within Medinet Habu on the west bank of Thebes. First of all, I will give a very selective overview of some of the, whether we stick with biscriptural texts, but texts that employ both Greek and Coptic from each site. I will then discuss the differences in the scripts employed in the texts that I'm discussing. And as a brief caveat, this is not the only form of biscripturalism in Coptic or Coptic Greek. For example, I'm only talking about non-literary texts, and so cursive scripts as opposed to Coptic literary works written in book hands, which do have the introduction and part of it written in a different script. We have different types of biscripturalism within single Coptic texts, single language Coptic texts, but specifically non-literary Coptic, bilingual Coptic Greek texts. So after comparing the scripts, I will address some methodological issues. And then finally, the context really comes at the end. The question of why do we have bi-scriptural texts of this kind in Egypt in the late 7th and 8th centuries? And so, examples. So my first example is from Hermopolis, either the late 7th or into the 8th century. In all of the examples, I have highlighted the Greek language sections in the red, the rest is Coptic. This is the only text for which I've provided a translation, because in practical terms, I'm not so much interested in the specifics of what the Coptic and Greek say, but the general use of language. And so here, to go over, do we have... Yeah, so the very beginning, this is the introduction. We have the invocation of God, the Bismillah, Suntheo, with God. And then the name of the first party, written entirely in Greek. This is the Arab or converted Pagarch Atius. And then it switches immediately to Coptic for the second party. And so the translation reading, this is a tax demand telling the recipient, Zacharias, son of John, how much taxes he is to pay. There is then a recapitulation of the amount of taxes in Greek, followed by the date, also written in Greek, and then at the very bottom, another recapitulation of the amount of taxes. And this is important in the sense of we don't have two separate sections saying, repeating the same thing, but one element of the Coptic, the price, is repeated in Greek. And this we'll see throughout the text that I discuss. So two examples from the monastery of Apo Apollo. In the first one, a demand from the superior who writes, I've obscured it partly, but in a not very accomplished hand, his signature. But here we simply have the date in Greek at the very end. This other one, again, we have the Greek, the date, sorry, in Greek. But then, both embedded in the text and as a recapitulation at the end, we again have a repetition of the price in Greek. And I will sound like a broken record with repeating it. Here we have a much longer document. This is from Aphrodito, dated 708-709. It concerns refugees who have left their own village and are found by a Muslim official in a different village, presumably tax evasion going on here or evasion of some form of duty, and they are imprisoned, captured, arrested by the Muslim official and taken back to Aphrodite, the place at which they are formally registered. And the majority of the document is in Coptic, but then we have, well, one, his signature of the scribe Theodore, written in Greek, but then this big section in the middle, which is a list of the names of the personnel of the families involved. So each line gives the name, always parents and children, with a account at the end in numerals of the number of people, and then at the end, the total number of people. So we have a different type of Greek. It's not just recapitulating an amount and it's not writing the date. It's much more extensive, but still it falls within administrative language. It's an account, so it's very restricted in terms of its linguistic repertoires. It's purely names, filiations, and numbers. Moving on to Thebes, and here's a difference. This is not administrative, this is a legal document. And the scribe, so as Jean-Luc said, the Aristophanes, who I've worked on for much of the past decade, and here it's a very long document, about 1.5 meters in length, written transversa carta, as we see. In terms of multilingualism, this is one of a number of documents with an Arabic protocol at the very top, this has no connection to the contents of the document. It's basically a production stamp put at the top of the roll when it's manufactured. At Thebes, they don't cut these off and reuse them. So a number of documents, the first on the roll, have it. So it looks like we have Arabic involved, but in fact, it's not pertinent to the contents. Here we have Greek in three different ways. His signature, as with Theodore in the previous text. The very beginning of the document, which is an invocation of the Holy Trinity. The date, and also mention of the officials, the local officials under whom, who are in control of the, well, leading the village at this time. So this is quite a long one, but normally it's very typical of this period, three or four lines at the beginning, written entirely in Greek. And then here we also see inserts of Greek embedded within the text as well. The invocation and the signature very much frame the document, and they're very formulaic. And I'll return momentarily to language competency, the issue of multilingualism or bilingualism must also be addressed. But here, this document is a sale of a house. We have in Coptic the sale price of 6 holokotonoi, the Coptic word for the Greek for the gold coin, the solidus. Pure of the measure of the castron Jamei, the name of the town. And then immediately, in a very abbreviated Greek form, and I'll return to this, we have a recapitulation of the price. So this same administrative function that we see in the entirely administrative text. And then this is also, it's not signed, but almost certainly by Aristophanes, but about 30 years earlier. This is a letter to a Muslim official requesting travel permits for 3 monks to travel from Thebes to the Fayum. And it's all in Coptic until at the bottom we have a list stating the name of the monk involved, the amount of poll tax that they've paid. So we go back to this administrative also connection with taxes, and I'll return to that. A description of them. One is described as corn-coloured, another is stout, one is knuckly. I presume he has big hands, it's not clear. And that they're all from the cup, the monastery of Avapol. And before I move on, so again, we have an account embedded, and the account is written in this very abbreviated form of Greek. For Aristophanes, this is the most extensive Greek in any of the documents that he wrote. About 25 papyrus documents and over 100 ostraca. In all of the other legal documents, his Greek is very formulaic, to the extent that it's learned phrases framing a text. Even the recapitulation of prices is entirely formulaic. And this Greek here is the most extensive. The question is, does this reflect greater competency, that he actually was competent in Greek at some level? Or is he actually monolingual largely, but able to integrate sections of this highly administrative type of Greek into his documents? So for me, Aristophanes himself is not bilingual. He's certainly first language Coptic with some degree of development or at least accumulation of Greek, but Greek for entirely functional purposes. And so when we're thinking of language competency and multilingualism or bilingualism and the effect on language, on script choice, this is one point. It's largely formulaic. For the other scribes, for example, Theodore, it's much more difficult to say, again in context, and the other scribes using these two scripts may have greater competency in Greek. This is not a general statement for all scribes using the two scripts, but as a almost disclaimer that Aristophanes is not bilingual, even if he is biscriptural or bigraphical. And on that issue, comparing the two scripts, because again, it's been very hard. I've just highlighted where they appear in documents. But as a close-up, one hand, when we look at the overall aspect, the overall appearance of the script, here, this is taken from the previous document. And the Coptic, some letters are taller, some descend a bit more than others, but it is largely bilinear. Whereas the Greek that he writes is clearly quadrilinear. So the aspect between the two is strikingly different. And we can look then, moving from just general aspect, we can move on to letter formation. So for Aristophanes, there are certain letters which can be used as diagnostic features. They show clearly distinct forms between Coptic and Greek scripts. And these are them. So we have beta as basically a triangle in Coptic, but then always the minuscule Greek style. Lambda goes from being smaller to having this very long left limb that descends a lot below the line. Mu has this Greek form which is more vertical and a tick at the bottom. However, sometimes this creeps into the Coptic. It's not always entirely separated with some letters. We can see that mu has a lot more forms anyway. Pi moves to being like a omega with a straight line, and upsilon loses the vertical stem. And this is consistent throughout Aristophanes' work to the extent that it helps identify Greek within the text where there is a script change. And when we move this on, Theodora Aphrodito, with differences for personal ductus, there are the same forms of beta, lambda, mu, pi, and upsilon. I haven't done the same comparison for Theodore, which would be the next step, but moving on to the number of texts that I didn't show, these are all text demands from the 8th century. Some are slightly fuzzy because of the quality of the images, and the sigla for the documents there, they all show a distinct change between the Coptic and the Greek forms. And the Greek forms are all of the same type that's for Aristophanes and Theodore. And so these are documents which cover several hundred kilometers. It's not a localized practice, it's clearly on a national scale. This Greek practice, this type of Greek script used for specific purposes embedded within the Coptic text, or at the end as a recapitulation. Returning to a small passage from Aristophanes' legal document, just to highlight the difference in letter formation within the text. So here we have the Greek word, arutzon, pure. It's written in full in Coptic. Won't go into how Greek is integrated in the Coptic, but in the abbreviated Greek form, the beta is clearly different, and the whole word is abbreviated. This is generally the trick. I don't think you'll find many, at least in Aristophanes, outside the invocation, Greek words written out in full and declined. It's the kind of Greek I wish I could write as well, just largely abbreviated without having to learn declinations and conjugations. And then the word for castron, written in full, and then even this word is abbreviated. It's the same word, they're both the same words, but they're abbreviated within this recapitulation. So even if Aristophanes knew how to decline the words properly, this style of Greek clearly is one that draws heavily upon abbreviations. And so here, when it's just written in straight lines, these features help identify the Greek, this specific Greek within the Coptic. And so onto some methodological problems, again, skirting around some terminology. But a couple of issues. One is how to identify a single writer in biscriptural texts. As I've highlighted, the Greek within the text is very different to the Coptic script. And in documents such as this that I've shown, when you have the list of people, the list of monks, which are not integrated within texts, but appended at the end and in the middle before the agreements of the parties involved, how can we be sure that the same person wrote this and it's not he? One person writes the Coptic and then another person writes the Greek lists, the work for administrative purposes. Well, this document is a nice example of showing the level of integration of Coptic and Greek. This is also by, not signed, but by Aristophanes, and the Greek there is highlighted, and it's not this clear-cut, this is Coptic and this is Greek, and even in the legal document with the really short recapitulation, the amount of integrated Greek here is much more extensive. So you have the address of the Arab official, Sal ibn Abdallah, the Bismillah, some Theo, written to Daniel, son of Pachom, from Jamie, all in Coptic. And then we get the year by the Hedra, written in abbreviated Greek. And then from here, we have the list of taxes, three different taxes, the names of the tax, the amounts involved, also the numerals identified easily by these diagonal strokes, and on, and then straight back into the Coptic. And then a recapitulation, so the date, recapitulation of the prices at the end. So with this level of integration, and it's clear that it's not a stop and pass on to somebody else, when we have this size of dossier, when we can look at an individual's practice over a large number of documents, we can be clear, certain, that it's one person writing both scripts. In other cases, when we don't have that degree of contextualization of a single person's work, it's much harder to produce that, and identifying ways of writer identification and verification is probably the next step, and I'll return to this. The other issue is distinguishing between scribes with very similar styles. In these cases, it's largely not a problem when they sign their name, but we're not always, in fact, we're mostly not that lucky to have signatures. And so, for example, here, this is by Theodore and by Aristophanes. This is an abbreviation at the end of Lambda. Written very, it's not a standard abbreviation, in other words, that ends with lambda, but this upward curl and a straight horizontal line. The gammas are very similar, this V shape with a long horizontal. So these texts are written 20 years apart and 100 odd kilometers separating the two sites. So they're not individuals working together. But with the nature of papyrus acquisitions, if these are acquired on the market with no provenance, with no names, how do we not only differentiate between different sites, but without other criteria within the documents, know where they come from one site or another? So I've already highlighted the Greek script, the same alphabet used between them. But as an example of the similarity in their writing, this is the Coptic preposition to you, plural. So we have the nu, eta, tau, nu, and it's remarkably the same. The ligature patterns, the ductus of individual letters, the spacing is incredibly similar. And as I said, these are not contemporary scribes working in the same area, but reflective of, and I'll return to this point at the end, probably a great systemization in a particular type of scribal practice and training. On how to identify the one from the many and the one from the one, mainly last year I haven't gone into it further, so I've come up with largely dead ends, but looking at modern scholarship on handwriting analysis. And so the paper by Jedi et al, 2013, refers to this issue of identifying two documents to the same scribe and separating the work of similar writings. So writer identification determines which writer amongst a set of known writers has written a given sample, so identifying the scribe involved. Writer verification is the task of finding out whether two handwritten documents are written by the same person or not. In other words, one-to-many and one-to-one problem. So the issues, the kind of issues shown just before. Another paper by Bertolini et al. Talks about different approaches to these, and largely two different kinds. One, segmentation process, features are localized, extracted from characters or allographs, and then global approaches identified based on overall look and feel. And I think this is always an important one. When you look at so many documents, you have the feel for who wrote them, and it's sometimes difficult to quantify that. It's like, no, this is by that person, like, certainly. How do you know? Because, it's once you go down the rabbit hole, you kind of see it everywhere. And so on to segmentation. This is an older article now in handwriting analysis, but the production of these code books, so to extracting the alphabets used by individual writers, so you have pattern books, basically, and this is hugely labor-intensive, and I was then felt justified in that I had done basically this for my PhD thesis, which I left out the book because I wasn't sure that anybody wanted to go over 40 pages of paleographic description. But this is for Aristophanes again, and what I did in my thesis, as a way of an aid to identifying his text and attributing unsigned text to him, is looking at letters, not just putting them all together, but whether they were unligatured, ligatured only to the left, to the right, or to both sides, because the very act of joining one letter to another greatly impacts upon their shape. So having an appreciation how letters change. I also produced. And ideally, this should, this certainly could, be done for all scribes that we can identify. So for all known scribes, we can have code books and we can use it as a comparison. It is very labor intensive. But as an example, so from Thebes, here is an extract of two works from the two documents by different scribes from the same village, Pasate and Aristophanes. They overlapped slightly in the 720s, but Pasate is known from the very end of the 7th century, so works really the three decades before Aristophanes, who starts in the 720s and works to the 750s. So they're almost contemporaries, but not quite. And in terms of segmentation, we can look at letter formation. So we have beta here, looks like a B, and then Aristophanes is more this round triangle shape. Zeta, slightly different shapes. We can look at ligatures. So epsilon rho, here two distinct shapes, but in Aristophanes, ligatured in this, what's called ace of spades ligature, it's very characteristic. Also epsilon iota, written two distinct shapes, but Aristophanes is nearly always this type of ligature where epsilon, the middle line, just goes straight down. And then you can extend it into words. You can do this throughout. This is just a few examples, but the word for Makarios, the blessed, so used for deceased individuals, abbreviated partly, but abbreviated greatly to just three letters with an abbreviation stroke. So segmentation is a very straightforward way for differentiating letters, ligatures, word groups from between individuals. And then we have sets that we can compare and say yes or no. It is labor intensive. So another practice which is used in modern handwriting analysis or has been introduced, which I think is very interesting, and I've been searching for a computer linguist slash somebody working that can maybe help apply this to the ancient documents, is the creation of these texture blocks. So the top one's from the Brazilian Forensic Library, and then the IAM, the handwriting database for English. And I don't understand the coding and the programming and the maths that they discuss in the article, so I will gloss over all of the techniques. But they produce these boxes of set size, which basically condense and reorder the letters so you can compare, and there's then mathematical equations for actually comparing density, height letters, and using these blocks then as ways to analytically compare one hand to another without focusing on word groups and various things. So it's taking a step back and not letting your biases impose on what you choose and what you select to segment. You ideally need quite a large data set to do this. For certain scribes, we have this, no problem. And it'd be very interesting to find a computer scientist willing to sit through. And obviously, the whole issue that we all work with on paleography is getting enough images of all the documents and high enough quality to start. But I think these are promising routes forward in terms of the analysis of paleography. And as I said, these are all a few years old. My search and handwriting analysis continues, but I think this interdisciplinary approach can lend very interesting points to us. And Judith will probably be more aware than I, but with the Geniza, this digital handwriting analysis and code books produced for Hebrew is already being done. So this article's now 7 years old. Although I think that largely it's interested in joining fragments, which intrinsically is author identification if you can be sure that they're by the same person. So Geniza, I think, is ahead of us in that respect. And so I think there's a lot of promise going forward. And I just want to end, I know we're over time, on why this script? Why this choice of two scripts in these kind of documents for these purposes? So after the Arab conquest towards, as the 7th century progressed, there were the introduction of a large number of impositions, both fiscal, the poll tax on non-Muslim adult males, and other taxes, taxes for the upkeep of Muslims, imposition of forced labor, corvées, requisition of goods, and so on and so forth. And take an example, I spoke about tax demands. In the trilingual environment of early Islamic Egypt, we have Arabic-Greek demands, Greek-only demands, and these Coptic/Coptic-Greek demands. So we have a large body of written material concerning the administration of the fiscal policies of the Arabs. And I think, well, my perspective is that Coptic is included in this, is integrated, and Coptic had not been used for such texts before the Arab conquest as a way for greater ease in disseminating the taxes and controlling the collection of taxes. I think it all comes together as part of ways to try and keep on top of the complex fiscal system in place. And in terms of, just one quick point, in terms of, I've mentioned unification of writing styles, and I think that's been clear throughout with, despite the distances involved, we have a great similarity in style. But just this Suntheo, the Riv Gardler, uses the Bismillah at the beginning of a lot of documents. These are examples from Coptic tax demands, and these are examples of scribal practices, probably. And we see across time, time is a problem, dating is a problem, but throughout the course of the 8th century, we see this great similarity in the writing of formulaic components of documents. And I think that the only way to account for that is that there must be some form of top-down imposition of scribal training. And this would then account for why the same Greek style, one, it's imposed it's probably created in environments that have this bilingual or scribes that can function between the two in an administrative office, but also then how it disseminates throughout the country the same styles. So as just to recapitulate that, I think we have this particular kind of biscriptality that I've described in early Islamic Egypt, reflects the use of Coptic as a result of empire-level activities, so both funds for within Egypt plus building in Damascus, paying the army for the continued war efforts in the Mediterranean and further east. The local response to this in Egypt is to use Coptic and integrate Coptic into the administrative framework, and that draws upon Greek and chancery practice, this Greek minuscule style. It's indicative of increasing centralization. However successful tax collection may be, and it wasn't at certain times, it's an attempt to keep on top of it, to maximize bureaucratic control, and then we get this unification of styles and systematization of scribal training. And so I think the biscriptality is functional. It's set in a specific context of this administrative framework within the early empire. It's a form of biscriptality in Coptic that hadn't been seen previously. And I think on one hand, it's finding this, which is not necessarily bilingualism, but functional biscriptality, and to return to Revel, this is biglyphia or bigraphism, because in essence, it's the same alphabet, but we have glyphic styles in Bunchich's terminology. I don't know if there's a really important difference between glyphic and graphic. I don't know how actually functionally different they are. But it's a phenomenon that we certainly see, and I think it's a phenomenon that we can account for in terms of political history of the period. On that, I thank you very much for your attention.